You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Robert Pippin, the Evelyn Stephenson Neff Distinguished Service Professor of Philosophy at the University of Chicago and author of The Culmination. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
At some point when I was writing a book about Hegel's Science of Logic, I realized that the only other philosopher who had the same interpretation that I did was Martin Heidegger. So wanting to understand why Heidegger thought that Hegel's position fundamentally didn't work, that something had been left out, that something had been forgotten or missed, led me to a very serious engagement with Heidegger's major works. Heidegger's term is Destruktion of the metaphysical tradition, and it's a little extreme. It sounds like he's sort of taking a shotgun and trying to kill it. But when Heidegger says he wants to destroy the Western tradition, I think he wants to destroy the priority of a certain kind of insistence that before anything else is important, the facts are important. So Heidegger thought we had prioritized the question of knowledge to such a degree that we had given it a kind of significance as the primordial relationship to being, to all of reality, that he thought had excluded other areas of significance in human life, and by excluding them, allowed us to think of the world as, in a way, there for us. So that being in the world is just that which could be the subject of a discursive assertion. And of course, he connected this to the kind of predatory stance of contemporary technology, which is essentially destroying the world because it considers the world as just material stuff, which we can understand and manipulate for our own ends. So that whole interrogative cognitive approach to the world has consequences for the way we think of ourselves as objects in the same way as objects of cognition, the way we think of ourselves in terms of medicine, of the economy, of business. And I don't think Heidegger has any objection to rationality. I think he wants us to think more about rationality as an issue of meaning in human life, about forms of thought other than discursive assertion with fixed truth conditions, that there's a form of truth that is not a form of correspondence between propositions in the world, but a form of disclosure of something being shown to us that we haven't been able to see without art, painting, or music, or fiction, or poetry. Heidegger's notion of truth is a much more experiential and less propositionalizable experiential dimension when he talks about revelation or disclosure. And the difficulty is that when philosophers hear that something in a novel by Henry James or a poem by Wallace Stevens has been disclosed, that we see something truthfully in a way that we haven't seen before, thanks to the work of art, philosophers want to say, well, if you're telling me that something is disclosed by the wasteland that we wouldn't understand otherwise, what is it? And that means translate that into a proposition. You're inevitably led to empiricism, that there has to be some empirical confirmation condition that can defend the claim that you've understood something truthfully by the appreciation of an artwork. And that is a kind of colonization of all modes of truth by philosophy. It would be like saying in a literature class, if you're teaching a poem by Shakespeare, take the sonnet, "My love is nothing like the sun." And a student asks you, "What does that mean?" And you say, "Well, it means my beloved is not very pretty, but it's okay with me." And you say, "Well, wait, you just sort of ruined the poem." You've got to be able to encourage the student to experience the poem again in a heightened self-consciousness, but not by paraphrasing or translating it. I think really the experiential implications of teaching things like the arts to kind of awaken a humility in students about what they don't know and what needs to be thought about, but not thought about in terms of articles for professional philosophy journals, but considered in a way in which conversations among people in classrooms reading really interesting texts together can start to illuminate what we don't know and what we've taken for granted in a way that we shouldn't be. There's something about reading Shakespeare together in a classroom that I have more hope in if it's taught well and if it's animated by a sense of seriousness than professional moral philosophy. But even that is disappearing as literature, for example, is taught more as a kind of example of a sociological way of understanding what kind of society would produce literature like this, rather than the kind of awakening and humbling that Heidegger is hoping for. There are these non-disclosive modalities of intelligibility. They don't need to be colonized by philosophy to be significant and perhaps even more significant than various lists of propositions. If you ask somebody, what did it mean to you that all of your friends were killed in the war? You don't expect a list of propositions in psychological prose, what you expect is a narrative, a kind of story. You don't expect, well, it means proposition one, proposition two, proposition three. You want a kind of account that will help you feel, or what Heidegger said, be attuned to Stimmtzeit, being attuned to this mode of disclosure in a way that doesn't allow itself to be reformulable propositionally. And the kind of dominance of the scientific attitude that anything that isn't formulable this way is, you know, basically bullshit, indeterminate, vague, mystical, that is destroying us, according to Heidegger. It is so limiting our capacities for understanding ourselves that we have become, in a way, thoughtless in the pursuit of a kind of efficient control of the environment for the sake of maximum preference satisfaction, the contemporary economistic model of rationality, that we've lost touch with what any of this struggle for control and manipulation is for. And this is, of course, one of the most controversial things in Heidegger. That the original understanding of being as knowable intelligibility has influenced an enormous number of practices that Heidegger thinks eventually have cut us off from all sources of meaning in a possible life other than this successful control of the environment for our own satisfaction. And in that sense, he wants to destroy that. He wants to find a way of showing us that this way of living is actually destroying us existentially, refusing to allow us to confront other sources of meaning in ways that aren't really formulable in discursive propositional prose, not really subject to the kind of truth conditions we insist on. And Heidegger thinks we may have reached a point where we're not even able to say anymore, this is the worst, where we have forgotten so much that we think of what would be experienced as the worst as normal, as just the everyday, as just what life is. So great literature, especially modernist literature, which is literature of alienation and despair and doubt, can awaken us at least to what we've lost. So one of the ways of looking at Heidegger is that in this situation of intense crisis, he and many others, especially those who in the 30s joined the Communist Party, thought that radical solutions were called for. That is the most dangerous thing about his philosophy, that when you come to a philosophical position in which you think the resources of the tradition are no longer adequate for, in effect, defending ourselves against unpalatable alternatives, you're tempted to take extreme measures. If you ask yourself, what is the major philosophical position that represents hope for a more equal and just society? It's certainly not the Democratic Party in the United States or the SPD in Germany or one of the many left parties in France or the Liberal Party in England. I mean, there isn't much of a consensus about what to do. I think sensible and caring people would like there to be more equitable income distribution, a more humane tax policy, early childhood education, universal health care, perhaps even a guaranteed income. But in terms of the options that are being discussed, there isn't a coherent philosophical alternative to market economic capitalism. And again, now, Heidegger is relevant here because normally when we would ask ourselves, what's responsible for the basic wrongness of the world, the banality of most ordinary lives, the boredom, the ever more simplification and stupidification of labor, you'd think it's the basic steering mechanisms of society, the economy, national government, to some extent still religion. Well, Heidegger's point is that we have to ask ourselves a deeper question. Why does the form of life that we live, particularly in the West, seems so inevitable? And he thinks there are much deeper presuppositions behind the fixity and unmovability and unresistibility of capitalism and consumerism and the growing dependence of technology. This is one of the things Heidegger was quite prescient on, that technology is not just a tool that we use to achieve our ends. It actually infects the meaning of our lives. We know we're facing the extermination of life on the planet, and we've not stopped doing it. The measures are inadequate. And I don't think we understand why we find it so difficult when we're faced with such a catastrophe not to be able to rally a powerful international movement with restrictions on what's causing the problem. Something's wrong about the way we're thinking about our deepest assumptions about what is rational, what is meaningful. We tend to think of the question of meaningfulness now as a matter of just subjective preferences. We don't seem to realize that we inherit a kind of world of possible meaningfulness that we are not really the subjects of, but subject to. And we're thoughtlessly assuming that the nature of our preferences and the things we think of as mattering are up to us, whereas they're very likely not up to us. So he thinks this recovery of the fundamental issue of meaningfulness requires going back and reading, say, Aristotle's Physics all over again, or Plato's Sophist, or Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. That's not something that's going to be in the high schools anytime soon. It is necessarily what we would now call a kind of elitist enterprise. And then you ask, well, what is the hope that Heidegger being able to convince a small group of philosophers with enough German, French, and Greek to read these texts is going to have the kind of resonance in the world that will address the crisis of meaningfulness that Western metaphysics has created? Well, the answer is not much. It's not going to have much of an influence. This is not that kind of thing. There ought to be many, many political movements addressing the injustices and inequalities in the world. But there is no possible political movement to address the problem of boredom, of banality, routinization of life. There's no way of just saying, well, here's some therapy for that. The problems are not reachable by programmatic means. So you can say, well, that's a source of despair. What are you saying? We just can't do anything about it. Well, yes, we can't do anything about it. If you've posed a problem in that way, then what you're trying to do by agreeing to do these kind of podcasts or something is to just try to address in a more general way what the problem is. So you can sort of awaken a certain dissatisfaction, a certain humbling, a certain not taking for grantedness about the way we are living. I'll take that. It may not be programmatic in the way that we'll found a political party. But look at how much irony there is in contemporary art, how much unhappiness is the focus of contemporary literature and poetry. At least that is a kind of awakening. And I think Heidegger thinks that philosophy can be that kind of awakening as well. But that doesn't get us very far down the road to a more fulfilling life for more people. I don't think there is, you know, quote unquote, a way out. We don't know what to do by knowing just that we're not going on very well. I think well-meaning people should continue to work towards a woman's right to control her own health care, early childhood education, universal health care with a single payer system, all of the things that seem right now in the political climate in the United States impossible. So the fact that Heidegger thinks of political solutions as already reflecting part of the problem because of their thoughtlessness, that there's this huge influence in the original understanding of being as knowable intelligibility has influenced an enormous number of practices that Heidegger thinks eventually have cut us off from all sources of meaning in a possible life other than this successful control of the environment for our own satisfaction. And in that sense, he wants to destroy that. He wants to find a way of showing us that this way of living is actually destroying us existentially, refusing to allow us to confront other sources of meaning. We don't treat the beauty of nature as something we want to own to amuse ourselves. I mean, some people do, but they don't really get it. The beauty of nature is an indication of a kind of purposiveness in nature that fits us at a level beyond our mere desire to satisfy ourselves. Something about the significance of the beautiful in nature reassures us that we have a higher vocation than mere entertainment and enjoyment. Some solemnity, sublimity in our ability to appreciate the beauty of nature is encouraging.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.